The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters.
I grew up in Silicon Valley out here in California, and I've been, you know, coding and using computers since I can remember. My dad had an internet business that he started in our garage in 1993. So I was really young at the time, and I think a lot of kids, you maybe fix cars or play catch or whatever with their dad, right? I was building websites. That's what we did together.
Hello, and welcome to The Hearing, a legal podcast where we have insightful conversations with interesting people connected to the law. I'm your host, Jennifer Thibodeau, and I'm here with my co-counsel, so to speak, Lauren Sobel.
I see what you did there, Jen. And if listeners don't get the co-counsel reference, they certainly will once they listen to this episode. And that's because today we are sitting down with Jake Heller. Jake is, among other things, a former lawyer and one of the founders of a company called CaseText, which created a generative AI product called CoCounsel. And Thomson Reuters actually acquired CaseText last year. Jake is now the head of product for CoCounsel here at Thomson Reuters. And since generative AI is everywhere right now, we couldn't wait to have Jake on.
Yes, we have wanted to bring Jake on the show since the acquisition, not only to hear about CaseText and CoCounsel, but also to learn more about him. And I have to say, today did not disappoint. We got to hear about Jake's original vision for CoCounsel way back in 2013 and the evolved version that is CoCounsel today.
And not to mention, we also got to hear how Jake started coding as a young child and how he was so advanced for his age when it came to programming that he was actually cheated out of a well-deserved science fair award because they assumed that his dad helped him.
Yes, and that, plus hearing him talk about his family and his parenting philosophy, were definitely highlights for me today.
Absolutely. I actually loved hearing that Jake is raising his own co-counsel in the form of four. Yes, that's four sons. And that one of them is already doing his own coding of sorts at a very, very young age. It was just one of the ways we got to hear about how Jake's personal and professional journey intersect. And, you know, often people are not as frank about that stuff. So I really appreciated that about our conversation.
Absolutely, Lauren, me too. Overall, this was a real treat. So now, our conversation with Jake.
The Hearing.
Hi, Jake, and welcome to The Hearing.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yes, welcome, Jake. We're so excited to speak with you today.
Well, why don't we dive right in and hear a little bit about you? We have a global audience, so can you tell us who you are and what you do?
Sure. My name's Jake. I am currently the head of product for CoCounsel here at Thomson Reuters, where I'm helping lead the effort to take a lot of our artificial intelligence tools and capabilities and make that into one AI assistant that can help across all of our professionals that Thomson Reuters serves, starting with legal professionals. And right before this, I was the CEO and co-founder of a company called CaseText, where we actually started working on CoCounsel. Recently, we were acquired by Thomson Reuters, which is how I joined the business. And that was maybe 7 or 8 months ago.
Great. Well, so since CoCounsel is having a bit of a moment, shall we say, we obviously wanted to talk to you a bit about it. But we are also hoping to talk to you more about yourself and your background. But I guess we'll start with CoCounsel. So Jen and I obviously are your TR colleagues. We've had the benefit of trying out CoCounsel. But for our listeners who may not have had the chance to see what it can do and what it's all about, can you give us your elevator pitch about CoCounsel? And maybe because this is a legal podcast, if you want to start with CoCounsel Core, that would be great.
Totally. Think about CoCounsel like your AI legal assistant. And by an AI legal assistant, I mean really two things. One, you can talk to it like it's a colleague. So, you know, ask it to do something for you and it natively understands what you're asking for it, you know, for it to do. Or if it doesn't, it'll ask for clarification. So first of all, you can talk to it like it's a colleague. And second, you can delegate to it really difficult, complex legal tasks and expect them to be done at a high level of quality but also at superhuman speeds. So the kinds of things you could ask it to do might be review documents, 1, 10, 100, 1,000, a million, we have the capability to offer. And it will read through those documents one by one, answering literally whatever question you may have about them. Like, is there any evidence of fraud, or how did the court rule in this case, or what have you? Any document, any question, in any language. You can ask it to review contracts. You can ask it to do research for you if you have Westlaw Precision and that connection's enabled. You can ask it to draft letters and other documents for you, and much, much else. So that's the idea behind CoCounsel, is you can talk to it and ask it to do things for you, and it goes and does them and brings you back an answer at superhuman speeds and at kind of, I would say, human level capability or accuracy.
You mentioned the TR acquisition. So this CoCounsel really started as a legal product, but it's sort of expanded, right? So can you talk to us a little bit about how, you know, your vision for CoCounsel has evolved into what it is currently?
I think being part of Thomson Reuters has given us an even broader scope and broader impact that we hope to make through the CoCounsel product. So it began as an AI legal assistant. But as you note, Thomson Reuters provides services and software and data to many other professions outside of legal. And the vision for CoCounsel today is to be an AI assistant for all professionals, at least all professionals that we serve here at Thomson Reuters. And just like in the legal context, we expect that in the future, for any of the professional groups that we serve, they'll be able to just talk to their CoCounsel. It will understand what they wanted to do, and it will also understand what tools it has at its disposal. Can it do research through Checkpoint Edge? Can it do background investigations or people investigations through CLEAR? Can it do can it look up information in practical law and find practical guidance and templates or other kind of really useful information and use that to draft something or write something or take the next step? So, for users of Thomson Reuters products, it should, on the one hand, get a lot easier because you don't have to know what database to search, what product to open up. You just talk to your assistant and it will go use those products for you. But it also become way more powerful because it can start taking the kind of next step beyond just searching for the information or finding information, but actually using that information to provide you with a memo about the research it just did, or a first draft of an agreement, or an edited agreement, in compliance with your guidelines or what have you.
Going back to CoCounsel, I have heard you refer to the Justice Scalia sarcasm test. And I thought that was a really good way of putting CoCounsel into context. Can you explain to us, can CoCounsel actually detect sarcasm?
Yes. And what it detects so much more too, subtle hints in languages. Going back a time a bit, we as CaseStacks, before we joined Thomson Reuters, were working on this new technology called large language models. Now, then new, now I think everybody's probably heard about them. The technology that powers ChatGPT, GPT-4, and all the other really exciting advancements in artificial intelligence over the last couple of years. We've been working on this since 2017, 2018, and saw extreme promise in it. And in part because of that, we had a pretty close relationship with OpenAI, the company that has created a lot of these breakthroughs in this technology. And I remember very distinctly them coming to us in middle or maybe third quarter of 2022. And they said, we have something we want to show you. We think this is a model that may actually do something for law. And so we, before ChatGPT was released or announced, before GPT-4 is released or announced, we were working with GPT-4 in secret under NDA with OpenAI. And we were blown away immediately. We ran many tests through it. For example, can you tell in a very difficult kind of legal language whether one court was overruling another court, for example? And it could. But one of the hardest challenges is we gave it, you said the Justice Scalia sarcasm test. And we took a passage where, it's pretty obvious to a human reader that no, Justice Scalia does not think that golf is the most important issue that, you know, the Supreme Court should be deciding something about PGA and golf or whatever, right? But so far up to that point, every single AI model, all machine learning models, et cetera, had all kind of failed that test. It's incapable of really seeing and truly understanding what was happening in that passage of text. But lo and behold, you know, GPT-4, a much more capable large language model, much larger, much more intelligent, you know, model than anything we've ever seen before, was able to do it easily, right? Another test that my co-founder put together, which I think is really funny, is he created a fake email. And the email said something like, you know, from Susie to Sally, subject, privilege to meet an attorney or something like that. And the subject of the email was like, it'd be such a privilege to meet the actor who plays, you know, lawyer on Law and Order. It would be my privilege to meet him. I'd love to discuss attorney-client, you know, privileged communications with him, et cetera, et cetera. And the email to a human reader is clearly not privileged, by which I mean it's not clearly not the kind of attorney-client communication that, at least under American law, you know, is not, you know, discoverable. You can't, you know, it's kind of like held secret, et cetera. But, you know, and again, every single machine learning model up until this point would all fail the test. They'd say, this is the most privileged email I've ever said. It says privileged, you know, 20 times, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But GPT-4 said, why would that be privileged? Of course it's not privileged. It's an email about an actor on Law and Order. And I think the big takeaway here is, for the first time, really in the history of artificial intelligence and machine learning, we have machines that really kind of understand and read and logic through text that isn't just looking at the keywords and looking at, you know, what words are in there and drawing kind of inference from that. It's really understanding, right? It really can converse ably about these documents. That was the big breakthrough that let us think, okay, we can actually make this AI assistant that is, you know, very capable, very, very helpful in a legal context. You know, the state of the art of technology has finally caught up to a place where we think it's useful for professionals.
Well, I have to say those stories are great at really putting the technology into context. So let me say, without being sarcastic, to be clear, that lawyers typically are not on the cutting edge of technology. So I'm sure you've heard from lawyers who have said, oh, this new tech seems overwhelming or complicated, or why should I do anything differently? The way I'm doing things now is totally fine. So what do you say to lawyers like that who are resistant to this change in the profession?
You know, it's interesting. You know, Casetext was in business for about a decade. And basically from the beginning, our vision and our hope was to bring new and cutting edge technology to lawyers. And what was interesting is that there wasn't a change nearly as big as what happened in artificial intelligence over the last couple of years, right? That we were able to use machine learning and earlier versions of artificial intelligence to make change, to make an impact, make a difference. But it wasn't at nearly as big as what we're seeing right now. And the interesting thing that we observed is before, say, ChatGPT and GPT-4 and all these other kind of revolutions in technology, our conversation with lawyers was exactly that. They said, well, I do things a certain way. I'm very successful at doing them a certain way. Why do I want to change the way I'm doing things? But ChatGPT and GPT-4, for many in the legal profession, was a wake-up moment. And they said, this is so powerful, it is impossible to ignore. This is going to make an impact on the profession. And I could either be on you know, figuring out what's going on here and taking action. My firm could be the, you know, figuring out what's going on and taking action here, or I might be left behind. And so in some ways, kind of weirdly, and I was not expecting this, when there was a much more massive, you know, fundamental change in the technology, that's when people really started paying attention, and you stopped hearing, at least in our conversations, we stopped hearing the, this is too overwhelming, it's too new, it's too different, I can't figure it out, I don't want to spend the time on it, life is fine already. And because I think people are sensing now that there's a really kind of like fundamental change afoot, that they really got to be paying attention. So we're actually hearing that less and less, even as the technology is getting more and more powerful, which is a little bit surprising. But another kind of like piece of it too is, even as the technology is getting way more advanced, and if you were, you know, to get a PhD in the subject, you'd still probably, you know, by the time you finish a PhD, you'd be out of date because it's changing so rapidly. So the technology is super complex and super hard. But the products that come out of it, products like CoCounsel and others, including ChatGPT, others in the legal tech industry and elsewhere, are actually easier and easier to use, right? Because you just talk to it and it understands what you're saying and it does the action, right? So less knobs and to, you know, to turn and buttons to push and so on. We're actually at a state right now where despite the fact that the technology behind the scenes, like how the sausage is made, is like pretty complex, the end user experience is never been easier, I would say, for lawyers to learn and adopt and start using kind of from day one. So I think for both those reasons, the kind of ease of use, but also the really like large impact it makes on practice, that kind of thing we're hearing less and less.
Well, I confess I'm not really tech savvy, but I think you're right. Once you go in and you actually try and play around with the technology, you realize it is not overwhelming and it is not complicated to kind of just get in there and figure it out. So that makes sense.
And I think, by the way, we're just now at a time when things are at their very beginning. This is version one of CoCounsel. You know, GPT-4 is the latest model from OpenAI. You know, Gemini 1.5. As things evolve, it's going to get increasingly powerful and increasingly easier to use. And so I think this trend, you know, I think people who start today are advantaged because they're going to get their heads around it a little better and they get their, you know, practice in, their reps in, understanding the technology. But I think that we're all going to be rewarded in, you know, this year, the next year, the year after that, with increasingly easy, increasingly powerful models. One kind of interesting conversation we were just a part of, we were at an event where kind of a small event for executives where Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, was talking. And one of the things he said, two things he said actually stuck out to me. Both of them were kind of mind-blowing. The first was, GPT-4, we now consider within OpenAI to be a stupid model. We think it is, like, kind of embarrassed by it. And this is the model, again, that's reading Scalia and in a second understands,
yeah,
right? Like, that's sarcasm, that's not, this is not a privileged email, et cetera. Whatever they're working on right now, you know, maybe just marketing, but I know this organization, and I'm impressed by the organization and their kind of candor and directness. When he says something like that, that kind of goes to show you that whatever's going to come next is going to be even smarter, right? Yeah. And even more impressive. It's almost hard to imagine. The second thing he said that I think you might find interesting is kind of said a throwaway line, but I thought it was a fascinating line. He said, there's no baby that will ever be born again that will at any point in their whole lives be smarter than the smartest AI models, right? There's, because the AI models keep on improving at the rate they're improving. You're never going to have somebody born who will be able to catch up to where artificial intelligence is.
Wow.
We're entering a kind of crazy moment, you know, where we're about to see these things, you know, and I think to some it's a little bit scary. To me, it's exciting, right? We're going to get a lot of help from technology in a way that we've never had that kind of help before.
So speaking of babies, we do want to talk about your family, and I think Jen will touch upon that later. But in terms of your baby CoCounsel, was it difficult for you to sort of give up what you had been, you know, working on for 10 years? Maybe give up is not the right word, but sort of have someone like TR come in and say, we want to take your baby and do other things with it. What was your reaction, and what was the thought process you went through?
I think a little bit like it felt like, and my kids are very young. My oldest is 4.5. So I don't know exactly what the emotion is like of your kid graduating high school, going to college is like yet. But I imagine it's pretty similar, which is to say, like, it's okay, we've reached a different level where, you know, this quote unquote baby CoCounsel is ready to do much bigger things than what it can do kind of at home alone with us. Right. And so it's bittersweet, right. But mostly sweet though. It's like a really proud moment when, you know, it's not like we stopped working on it, by the way. Like, it's all, I wake up, I think about CoCounsel all day and go to sleep. So it's the same as it was as when I was running case techs. But now, you know, we have a lot more people working on it. We have a lot more resources. We have a lot more inputs, including, you know, Westlaw and Practical Law are going to be, you know, integrated into CoCounsel, and CoCounsel will be integrated into those tools in ways that make it both easier to access, because it's going to be where most legal professionals work, like in places like Westlaw. But also, for the first time ever, CoCounsel have access to Westlaw's amazing library of content, right? So if you have Westlaw Precision, and you connect that to CoCounsel, then all of a sudden, every time you research, it's going to be employing Westlaw's what they call AI-assisted research skill, and it will exercise its capability to do research against the best database of legal materials in the world by utilizing Westlaw. Same thing with practical law. It's going to start looking at expertly crafted templates and guidance and advice. That's the kind of things that we just could never do when we are, case decks working alone. We did not have that kind of content, subject matter expertise, experience with customers, et cetera. And so I think our kid is graduating, and it's moving on to this next step where it's going to be able to do a lot more, take in a lot more information and do a lot better than it could have done before. So again, it's different, but it's really exciting.
So this baby, so to speak, was born in 2013. And at the time you were an associate in big law and then you left to go and do this thing. So can you talk a little bit of how that came to pass and what your vision was at the time?
Yeah. So my background, even before then, I grew up in Silicon Valley out here in California and been, coding and using computers since I can remember. My dad had an internet business that he started in our garage in 1993. So I was really young at the time. And I think a lot of kids, you maybe fix cars or play catch or whatever with their dad, right? I was building websites. That's what we did together. And so for me, like almost like in my genetics, in my DNA, I was somebody who loved building things on the computer, building computer programs, building websites, etc. And so even as I went through law school and did kind of a clerkship, work for government, work for a big law firm. My gears were always turning about how might we be able to build things to help with the everyday things that I was going through. And I remember very distinctly at the law firm that while when I was using like my cell phone, I had like one of the early iPhones or using Google or what have you, I felt like technology was really awesome. Could find, movie times near me in an instant. And then when I logged in to work and had to do like review documents or review contracts or do research or anything else, it felt like technology was like 10 years behind. It felt like I was almost working against my technology. So as where I could find like movie times in an instant, finding that one case that would help me like win my matter, convince a court or find that one document that's the key piece of evidence. Well, that might take me till 5 a.m. 3 nights in a row. And the disparity felt like really, I really believe in our legal system and our justice system. And for lack of a better term, it felt almost unjust, right? Why is it that I could find like restaurants, like trivial stuff, like restaurants and movie times and, like reviews of like games and stuff. Like that's like really easy to find and use using technology. But when it's something that where like a business may be on the line or even somebody's freedom might be on the line, that was really like hard. The technology was not helping me in the way that consumer technology was. So the big vision going into starting CaseText was, what if we took the best of what we're finding, kind of outside of law, but using consumer technology and other areas of technology I was really aware of, like technology around helping people code and learn about code. What if we took those best practices and applied it in the legal space? And to be honest, it really shifted over time, over the decade that we ran CaseText. In the early days, for example, we focused a lot on how do we build a database, not unlike that like Westlaw or Practical Law has, but using kind of crowdsourcing. Like what if we went the same kind of path as Wikipedia, or for those who know it, like GitHub or Stack Overflow, these kind of technical tools. And anyway, long story short, that was not a really intelligent way of building, in legal. Like we didn't find the same. They're unlike the kind of Wikipedians who contribute knowledge and information freely. We couldn't find really great lawyers to do that enough to make a difference. But what we did find kind of through that journey was that a lot of the very early explorations in artificial intelligence, natural language processing, and machine learning were really paying huge dividends in terms of the user experience, search better, summarizing documents, understanding documents, better, and even generating some basic content that that put us in a place where we're developing a pretty good resource. And we started leaning heavier and heavier into some of these technological aspects. And so over time and pretty early on, the focus shifted away from kind of the earliest kind of iteration of the business and more towards machine learning, artificial intelligence. And again, like we were constrained by, I'd say, the state of the art. Like, the state of the art is not then in 2015 or 2016 what it is today. So we were able to only offer certain kind of versions of the vision. And as the state of the art of technology and hardware and software to support kind of more and more ambitious things got better, we offered, I think, increasingly exciting products, culminating in CoCounsel.
You mentioned when you were at a very young age, you started coding, and you were obviously someone who is very, very passionate about technology. What made you decide to go to law school? What was it that pulled you in the legal direction at first?
It's funny, you know, how these kind of things happen, but I almost by chance found myself in speech and debate in high school. And that was the activity that I really found. It's a kind of, I did two things in high school, maybe three things. I met my wife, most importantly. Second, I did speech and debate. And third, I coded. And I didn't do like schoolwork, so my grades are terrible. But I really loved speech and debate. And I did this type of debate called policy debate, where one side of the debate, the so-called affirmative side, proposed a plan, a policy. And the other side, the negative side, would try to negate why that policy was a good idea. And I really thought this type of policy debate was really intellectually satisfying, but also, you know, these things really matter. Like, we were talking about issues that really matter. And I thought, oh, if I can like have a career where all I did was focus on interesting ideas, new laws to be passed or laws that should be repealed, that would be a really exciting and fun kind of experience. So I went to law school with the idea that I'd maybe someday be like a Senate staffer or, you know, work at a think tank or something like that. And, you know, I got actually, you know, as I went to law school, I fell more and more in love with the actual practice of law. Like, I did clinics really liked my classes, really liked my professors. And so found myself going more and more in the kind of more traditional legal path and legal education. But went in, you know, because of that, what began with high school, an excitement and interest around policy and legal topics.
So that's really cool to hear. I had somewhat similar experience where mock trial in high school is what led me to law school, and I had a very traditional path. When I hear you talk about that and your journey through the profession, I can imagine if you told us in 2013 your vision for marrying the technology that made it easy to find a movie or game reviews, whatnot, with finding that needle in a haystack document, that I would have said, yeah, you should definitely invent that, right? But was it hard for you to actually step away then from the law and actually take this big leap? Like, what was the personal decision-making like for you? And I'll add that I'm sure nobody here misses billing hours when it came to leaving the law.
So it's a great question. I think that in order to start any company, you have to have a certain amount of naivete, because if you knew exactly how hard it's going to be, you may not do it. So when I was choosing to leave the law firm, I thought a few things that in retrospect are pretty naive. First of all, I thought this is going to be really easy to build. How hard can this technology possibly? I've been coding my whole life, and I was actually able to put together like a demonstration of the technology over the course of like a few weekends in between things. After I left the law firm, before I really started working on it, I was kind of playing with some technology, and I was like, "Oh, that's pretty great." And obviously building a real product that people really use in production for their profession is really hard. So I think I was naive about how hard it would be to build. I also was naive about how fast success would come, because you read about all these success stories in Silicon Valley, and you know, it's like the way it's told is somebody invents the product, and then within months everybody's using it, and then a month after that, you know, they're IPOing and breaking champagne bottles in the New York Stock Exchange or whatever. You know, like, and then what everybody's telling you, actually, you know, if you're listening when you're starting a company, like all of your early investors, is be ready. It's going to take about 10 years to achieve any type of success. And again, I was very naive. I was like, well, maybe for most people, but we're going to figure out some way to make the success happen faster. And literally it was, you know, first of all, a very difficult product to build, and we had to go through many iterations and learn a lot of lessons the hard way. And relatedly, it took As my investors were saying, literally took 10 years before we were in a position where we had a product that was really flying off the shelves and people were really using a lot and, you know, rose to the kind of success and prominence that, you know, we, the kind of impact that we wanted to make when we started off with the business. And so, but if I wasn't as naive in the very beginning, I might have never done it. And again, like my invitation, but I actually thought in the very beginning, I didn't think I'd necessarily be successful in a few years. I thought I'd know for sure one way or the other. So I thought, okay, well, either we're going to be taking off and everything will be great, or we'll totally fail and just go back to being a lawyer. And hopefully I'll beg for my job back. Hopefully they'll take me back in just a couple of years. It's kind of like a 2-year leave of absence or something like that. And so I convinced myself that this is, again, going to be easy and fast. And it was neither of those things. And it's a great thing I did in some ways, because otherwise I don't know if I would have started the company. And it's funny, you actually hear this when you talk to other founders of companies, you hear this pretty consistently where, you know, if they're being like, well, at least a little honest, they'll admit to their, how naive they were when they started the company and how different it was kind of when you go through that experience and see what it's like.
So besides being, I guess, a little bit naive, which I was going to say, I have definitely heard that before. And I think it's a blessing, right, to have that, because there are so many things that wouldn't have come to fruition without it. What other skills would you say are responsible for, you know, the success, the wild success that you have had? You know, what sort of gave you the determination to keep going, you know, for 10 years when you thought it was going to be, you know, a year or two?
It's funny because, like, first of all, I say it's a wild success. And I think in retrospect, you know, we were very happy with where we ended up. But part of the way this thing works, in my experience anyways, is it's like not even close to a success for a very long time. You spend a lot of your time thinking, will this go anywhere? You know, how can we make it go? And I think, like, I guess to answer the question of like, how do we get to where we did? You do have to be incredibly determined. And there's never a point during the entire decade where I thought, oh my God, this is just not going to work. I can't explain it. You know, I just, for the entire time, I was just, you know, okay, well, if this idea didn't work, we'll try another idea. If we're almost running out of money, we'll raise more capital, find a way. If, you know, we run into this roadblock with sales, we'll find a way to help get the message about why this product is in fact valuable and just keep on working on it. So I think a part of it is like extreme determination, even in the face, again, of when if you were to step back and look at the reality of the situation, you'd say there's no reason why this person should be this determined and this convinced that things are going to go as well as they are. You have to keep on, I'd say, pushing through that. And the second thing is, hire really, really good people around you, I think helps a lot. I was very blessed to have two amazing co-founders. And from there, and they're part of the business now, Laura Safty and Pablo Redondo. And they help push you and help you see the light sometimes where even you don't see it. Or help course correct when you're making mistakes. And we all did this with each other, where, you know, one of us might be really determined to go this way and the other one was able to kind of talk some reality into you. And then from there, you know, a great team that ended up being a little over 100 people by the time we joined Thomson Reuters, all of really, really talented people. And that gives you a lot of energy when you're seeing everybody push as hard as they possibly can, or sometimes in the course of many, many years, oftentimes in the course of many, many years. And that I think is also a really important piece of it. Finally, I think, you know, a big piece of this too is, besides like never giving up and having a great team around you, to get there, is always finding like a path to success. Okay, well, this store closed and this store closed and this is not working out well, et cetera. But what, you know, what do our customers really want? And can we build that for them? Okay, maybe this technology path we're pursuing is not going to work out for a variety of reasons, but let's go back to the drawing board and, see if this other thing that we were investigating, you know, might. And the final thing that is a bit of luck. I mean, honestly, if the state of the art of AI didn't develop as fast as it did, you know, if it was another 5 or 10 years, we would be working at it for an extra 5 or 10 years, and that would be, you know, increasingly difficult. Of course, we had assumed that the AI work in some ways would advance quicker, which is why we were all in on AI for a very long time. And that would have been even better, obviously, from getting to the biggest customer value earlier, but it really could have been the opposite. And, you know, so there are things that are out of your control And there is a certain element of luck and timing that you have to be in the right place at the right time with the right technology and the right focus, or else it also may not work out for you. And that part is, you know, more fate than, and sometimes it's about making your own luck, and sometimes there's just nothing you can do. It's just the way the world is. And that's another piece of it too. Entrepreneurship was very hard.
I'm just going to make the quick comment, Jake. I think we've heard you say it took you 10 years to become an overnight success. And that definitely, definitely puts the context to that statement for sure.
Yeah. I mean, it's a saying actually in Silicon Valley. But again, when I was starting in 2013, I heard, and I was like, well, that's not a real thing, a 10-year overnight success. But that's literally, at least for us, what happened to us. And there are true overnight successes. And there are, you know, true companies that struggle for 10 years and are not, they never reach a level of success. That's no guarantee. But at least in our experience, you know, the idea of a 10-year overnight success is really true.
So we've all heard that Gen AI is coming for our jobs, and that Gen AI is going to put everybody, you know, in the legal profession out of business. Do you really think that's true for lawyers? Do you think Gen AI will put lawyers out of business?
No. I think that Gen AI is going to help assist lawyers dramatically, and may even take over some tasks that lawyers do, but it will not take over jobs. Here's why I think that. First of all, in the legal profession, we've gone through some massive changes of technology over the course of, say, the last, like, even like 50 years, right? We went from writing things on paper to having typewriters to having computers, from researching, going to the library, to researching on platforms like Westlaw, from not having the assistance of certain content sets, like the practical law content set stands out to me, to being able to start from like a template and have practical guidance and advice. You know, not being able to email, everything was telephone and mail, right, to email. These are pretty massive fundamental shifts in the technology that we use to support us. And yeah, it is a lot faster to do a search on Westlaw than to read through the books. And it is a lot easier to send a quick email or a text message than it was to write a letter or to try to connect over the phone, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And there are more lawyers now than ever, and we're making more money than ever. And I think that trend is just going to continue, where the technology will assist us with more and more and more. But there is not a single lawyer that I know, especially those working at the kind of top of the practice, or who are, you know, I'd say like very large firms or great plaintiff side firms, what have you, where if you ask them, like, if I gave you an extra hour in the day, would you be able to use it for work? They'd say yes. Or if I gave you an extra 10 hours every day to work, would you be able to use it to do better for your clients? They'd all say yes. There is so much that we are not doing that we wish we could be doing. So many services that we, you know, turn away from our clients. Like, very simple examples here is, how many times do companies know that a lawsuit against them is frivolous? They know the facts, but they feel like litigating the case would cost more than just settling it. So they settle, right? They give up. How many times are contracts not reviewed by lawyers, especially for small media businesses? But instead, the business owner says, the idea of going to a lawyer is going to be way too time consuming and way too expensive, so I'm just not going to do it, right? There's so much work that we are not doing right now that we wish we could be doing for our clients, that I think that the trend will continue as technology assists you more and more and more. It's going to enable us to do more and more for our clients. Maybe one other example of this outside of the legal space, but I think it's like an interesting analogy. The first thing that computers did, and we're really good at, is math. Right? Before they're good at language, they're good at math. And the manifestation of this was, I think, most impactful in industries, well, many industries, but one of the most impacted industries was accounting. Because before modern spreadsheet technology, you had to do a lot of this by hand, a lot of hand calculations. Now you have like an Excel, a formula that you can just drag across, you know, to the bottom, to a million rows, it'll do a computation for you, pretty advanced stuff, make graphs, et cetera, in a second. Are accountants out of a job now? No, they just graduated from doing hand tabulation to, you know, the big four accounting firms. My understanding have a combined revenue and employees, right? If you combine all those, that is equal to, if not greater, the Am Law 100, right? Big four firms as big as 100 law firms, right? Four accounting firms as big as 100 law firms. And they started doing things that they knew their clients wanted. Like they had insights into the, you know, flow of money into their clients. And now they can do things like strategy recommendations and technology recommendations and consulting, right? Just going way beyond what they were originally doing, because the technology, you know, moved from taking these really talented people and have them do hand calculations. And now that the computer is sending them calculations, doing much more advanced stuff. And I think that the unlock is going to be similar for lawyers. I think we have a deep insight into the contractual relationships of the businesses that we serve, the risks and regulatory risks, litigation risks that they're facing. And I wonder if the lawyer of the future will be able to kind of transform what we do for our clients away from kind of relatively rote stuff like reviewing millions of documents for litigation or what have you, you know, updating contractual language to meet the new standard for inflation in this so-and-so jurisdiction, and onto a much more interesting, impactful strategic work for their clients. So I think the short answer is no. I don't think we're going to see, fewer lawyers and lawyers losing their jobs to AI, et cetera. I think we're going to shed some tasks in the same way that accountants are no longer hand adding up, you know, rows in a spreadsheet, like a literal physical piece of paper sheet. You know, I think that we're going to look at the lawyers of today and say, okay, well, we were not employing these very, very smart, you know, postgraduate educated people to the highest use of their capabilities. And with technology, we hopefully are doing a little bit better at that. That's my perspective.
Definitely. And I could see, you know, this creating more and more jobs the same way, you know, the advent of e-discovery did, right? I can see prompt engineering legal jobs and you know, jobs at firms certainly to sort of help implement and make sure this technology gets used the way, you know, the best way it can.
Yeah, it's new jobs, new skills also. I mean, one of the things that I think a lot about is when I used this word earlier, I said, working with an AI legal assistant is a delegation. You delegate to your AI assistant. And the task of delegation or management is actually really hard, right? There's literally a whole degree around management, right? And lawyers are not generally the best managers. We are sometimes really bad at that. Like, you have to make decisions. Like, what do I do myself versus what do I delegate to others? How do I give clear instructions about what I want to be done? How do I give feedback and make sure that based on that feedback, they do a better job? These are all really difficult kind of things to do. And there's a whole degree around management, a whole discipline around management, and most people aren't naturally good at it. But now for the first time in history, everybody is going to have an employee, so to speak, right? This AI assistant. And your value used to be like, how are you going to grind through the work yourself? But now I think it's going to, you know, be more about like, how do I use my AI assistant or assistants to get more work done for me? How do I delegate effectively? How do I explain myself correctly? And I think that there's a whole, you know, I agree, whole new roles, but also whole new skill sets that pretty early on, we're going to have to start teaching people about how do you figure out, how do you work with this new employee that you have, this AI employee? Which I think will be a much more common thing across the workforce in legal and outside of legal as well. And so I think, again, that's exciting. You want to be promoted to be a manager, right? That's where most people's like career paths are going. In the not too distant future, I think every graduating associate and, you know, assistant DA and whatever else, you know, coming from the law schools is all of a sudden going to have an assistant, you know, right there. They're going to be a manager from day one. And I think that's going to be an exciting kind of moment.
Really interesting point there to hear about how our skill sets might change as well, Jake, because I agree lawyers aren't the best managers. If I can, I want to change gears now to talk a little bit about you and your family. You mentioned that you met your wife in high school, that your oldest child is 4.5 years old. We have also seen maybe your 4.5-year-old kind of on the screen in some virtual meetings here at TR. We saw you very sweetly holding your newborn during a large virtual meeting and referring to your baby as your co-counsel, of course. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about your family? And because you are someone who obviously has a very busy professional life, how you make it all work?
Well, how do I make it all work? That's the question I wish I had an answer for you. So you're right. I met my wife in high school, and we've been together ever since. So it's now more than half of our lives we've been together. More of my life has been with her than not. And that's also kind of like a lucky thing that we just found each other, you know, at that time. And it's very rare, obviously, especially these days, to find high school sweethearts who end up getting married. But sure. Part of how we make it work is, you know, we're a team. And I am very lucky. We both my wife and I work. We both have very busy jobs. But when you have two people who can kind of spread the load and can, you know, kind of accommodate, it's like, okay, I'm doing a podcast now, so you have to watch the kids at this time. And, you know, that makes things a lot easier. And so I think part of the answer to how, you know, two parents with four kids under five, you know, kind of make it work is you work as a team. And, you know, we are very lucky to have the kiddos that we do have, four boys. Life can be hectic at times. You know, early in the morning, if they're all up and all partying and all want your attention at the same time, things can get a little crazy. But and I think another thing too is not to be too personal, but we actually really struggled to have kids at first and really, really wanted kids. And it took, you know, maybe also another 10-year overnight success, took nearly a decade to have our first kid. And we really, really wanted them. And so now we just enjoy every moment. And I think this other piece of it too is, you know, you can be in a moment with your kids. And I know I'm there, and I'm sure a lot of parents are there where they're crying and screaming and you're like, this is the worst thing ever. but if you kind of reframe that as like, I get to be with these really cute kids and take care of their needs and spend time with them. And even at the kind of like darkest, hardest moments, if you have kind of gratitude also about that moment, which is very fleeting, right? I'm already seeing, even just the last like 4.5-5 years, how quickly and rapidly they're changing, which I already kind of, another cliche that I think is true is, you know, time flies really fast with these kiddos. You know, it's you're kind of reframing in your mind and kind of having gratitude about that moment, I think really helps, you know, what otherwise would sometimes be very dark, difficult moments, which we all have, by the way, me too. can't be perfectly zen about it all the time. It sometimes drives me crazy. But for the most part, we're having a great time.
That's amazing. And four boys under five. Wow. I have one son who is 7. So tonight when he is giving me a hard time at bedtime, I will definitely draw upon your advice to have that gratitude and that I get to moment as well, for sure. Because as they say, the days are long, but the years are short indeed.
That's right. That's exactly right. I will say I've found that one kid could have the strength and annoyance of four at times.
Thank you. You said it. I appreciate the recognition there.
Yeah. And then we've seen the really hard thing, by the way, is when you have all three or four of them, you know, all going at the same time. Oh, man. But again, it's for the most part, like, really kind of sweet. And they're very cute kids. We're very lucky to have them.
Do you envision ever coding with your sons like you did with your dad?
Oh, yeah, 100%. And I think that it's actually gone way, way, way easier to do that. So, you know, I was not a zero screen time child, and I think we're kind of passing along to our kids, not to talk too much about parenting philosophy, but a lot of my friends and peers, you know, keep their kids away from the iPad and the computer and so on. We're kind of the opposite. My oldest loves playing Minecraft. And it's just like totally dorky game. I didn't know anything about it until he somehow discovered it. And it's almost like Legos, but in a virtual world where you kind of can build whatever you want to build and kind of wander around this like crazy kind of block-like, you know, universe. You ever see the kind of art behind it? And he already at 4.5 is figuring out how to, like, you know, type into the iPad little cheat codes and little things to change the universe. And you know, it's amazing. He's learning how to write, how to read, just because he wants to play Minecraft better. And he's learning a very basic form of programming, in a sense, you know, how to control the computer environment to meet his kind of needs. So, and we're having a great time with it together. I now know much more about Minecraft than I ever thought I might need to or want to just keep up with him. And as other kids get a little bit older, I think that you know, maybe we'll have similar experiences. Only if they're interested. I mean, my experience, and I'm sure it's the experience of many parents, is your kids sometimes find interest in stuff. You're like, why are you just this? This is the stupidest, silliest, dumb little thing. But, you know, I just lean into it. I'm like, oh, great. We're going to learn about, you know, a particular type of train or, you know, Minecraft or, you know, my kid got really into flags. Now I know you know, all the flags of the world, you know, stuff like that. We just kind of lean in and let them, you know, let them kind of drive. So hopefully some of them will like code. I really like code. And the coding with AI is even easier and better. You know, there's a lot of coding AI assistance, just like there is legal AI assistance, that makes it even more interesting and easier to learn and kind of easier to kind of accelerate. And so I hope some of them go that direction, but some of them I'm guessing will not, and we'll see where that goes.
I have to say what I really like about your question, Lauren, and your answer, Jake, is that before this, I'd really been wondering, because I'd heard you say you started coding at such a young age, and I think I'm maybe a few years older than you. What I remember about coding and programming then was like that green turtle blinking on the screen. I don't know if that resonates. Yeah. Okay. So you're nodding, Jake. So I might be dating myself, but I'm in good company here. But then you fast forward to today, and just yesterday, I get pictures from my 7-year-old's first grade science teacher. They're on the floor coding robots and teaching them to move. So I was wondering, you know, how does Jake actually learn this that day and age? So that's really cool to think about, you doing that with your children. And who knows where at your age, right, when you were in law school, where they'll be and what their jobs
will
right.
be. That's right.
Yeah.
I will say my first ever program was in this programming language called BASIC, which is the programming language you used for the Atari, which is what we had at the time. Mm-hmm. These are all things that hopefully people never have to really learn about, because they're all defunct technologies basically at this point. And my first ever programming thing that I ever did was my own like Mad Libs, where I'd write these stories and then the computer would ask you for which words you want to put in, and then it put together this like silly story using the words you put in. I entered that in my science fair competition when I was, wow. I don't know, I was like 8 or whatever. I got last place because I thought my dad did it for me, and I got that.
Wow.
I'll never forget that.
Wow.
Yeah, can you reach back out to whoever did that and say, look at me now?
Yeah, right?
No, I'm not. I don't think I ever
get
will.
Your prize.
Yeah, exactly. I want my first place.
So Jake, I know you've talked a little bit about things that you're excited about right now, but our last question was going to be, what are you the most excited about now, whether it is in your personal or your professional life?
I think that both personally and professionally, this wave of AI is really exciting. And again, I think it's we're actually just at the dawn of it. I'm really excited to find out in the professional world what it's going to be like when these AIs are way more smart, way faster, way easier to use, and maybe even like built into all of our computers, right? So you don't have to like, even go out to the cloud to use them. I think they're going to start seeing these AI assistants pop up in like everywhere in our lives. Help me calendar something, help me think through something, you know, bounce ideas off of, educate me about something. We're already almost there with models like GPT-4 and Claude 3 and so on. And I think the next generation are going to be even more exciting. And I think that like, you know, I think a lot about like what my kids' future is going to look like with all of this, what their jobs should look like. You know, will they have jobs in the same way that we have jobs? I'm not sure. You know, maybe it'll look a little different. You know, I asked my kid, my 4.5-year-old, what he wants to do when he grows up. He says, well, I want to have a robot, and the robot's going to make money for me. It's like, how's it going to make money? It's like, he'll open a bunch of supermarkets for me. He had this whole idea. I think he's just being a kid babbling nonsense, but it was like, okay, maybe in the future we just have like, you know, AIs who work for us as opposed to like doing stuff ourselves. I'm not sure. I think it's, you know, it's always good to live in interesting times. I think we're about to live in very interesting times.
Well, I think there's no better way to end than with that. So thank you, Jake, for being with us.
Thanks, Jake.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really fun.
The Hearing.
Thank you for listening to our conversation with Jake. Before you go, please rate the podcast and leave us a review. It really helps other like-minded listeners find us. And don't forget to subscribe to be notified when our latest episodes drop.
We'd also love to hear your thoughts, your feedback, and ideas for future guests. So please drop us a line at thehearing@tr.com. That's thehearing@tr.com.
The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters. To find out more, go to tr.com/thehearing or subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.